This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Today, we're sharing not one, but two episodes of Vermont Public's podcast, Brave Little State. They answer your questions about our region and its people. Later, we'll hear about hunting culture in Vermont and how it's changed over time. But first, we're talking mail. Since it's the holiday season, many of you are probably taking more trips to the post office than you normally do. The woman who delivers my mail has been working late into the night these past few weeks. Ilsa, you are a rock star, and I appreciate you. But for many Vermonters, mail delays and post office closures are a perennial source of frustration. Brave Little State producer Burgess Brown takes stock of the U.S. Postal Service in Vermont and why it can be so slow. Let's listen.
I'm very happy to be a journalist, but I have to tell you that I sometimes think about another path, a fantasy career of sorts. It's my country mailman dream. In it, I drive a beat-up Forester full of mail in a small town somewhere. I know my neighbors, I know their dogs, I watch their kids grow up. How romantic.
Don't give up the dream. There's still a chance. There's still time. You can still make that happen, I think.
This is Ryan Ellis, and he's lived my dream.
One of the jobs I had right after college was working as a letter carrier, and I loved it. It was everything I'd hoped it'd be.
But academia came calling. Ryan is now an assistant professor at Northeastern University. His research focuses on what he calls the politics of infrastructure. That includes everything from computer networks to the United States Postal Service. Ryan loved the Postal Service as a kid because he felt like it connected him to a wider world. And he says this was actually a critical function of mail in this country from the very beginning.
It had a commitment to binding the entire nation together.
Ryan argues that even more than the First Amendment, the Postal Service was the foundation of free speech in early America. The Founding Fathers certainly thought the service was important. Benjamin Franklin was named the first Postmaster General in 1775. That's a year before the nation was founded. And then two decades later, George Washington called for massive expansion of post roads and construction of post offices across the growing country.
It circulated news and information in the early country in a way that was completely out of step with the peers.
This was seen as a public service and was funded with taxpayer dollars. The founders made it incredibly cheap to mail newspapers, pamphlets, and political magazines at the time. That flow of ideas and information to every corner of the growing nation was critical to the development of democracy.
It wasn't only serving heavily trafficked, dense urban cities. It wasn't only serving commercial hubs. It was serving everybody. And so this idea that rural areas, outlying communities, were also going to be integrated into the post office and by extension into the nation was a key foundation.
Neither snow nor rain, nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds.
This is the so-called Postman's Creed, a sort of informal USPS motto. And this is what gets me so jazzed about my country mailman dream. People love their postal workers. They're beacons of democracy. And especially in a place like Vermont, where they're out slogging through mud and skidding on ice to get us our mail, and increasingly, helping us to vote. In some Vermont towns this year, as many as half of voters cast ballots using the mail-in system. Post offices themselves are institutions in a lot of Vermont towns. They help neighbors stay connected to neighbors, sometimes just by existing. Like in the town of Elmore in Lamoille County. The Elmore Post Office is nearly 200 years old. It's tucked into the center of the Elmore store. Past the bread aisle, there's a little window where you can buy stamps and drop letters. The crown jewel is a wall of little golden post office boxes with little golden numbers and ornate designs. One of those boxes belongs to Mary Benford.
I know it's like snail mail, that's what they say, but I mean, it's a dying art.
Mary lives right upstairs above the store. She moved here a year and a half ago, direct from Philadelphia.
But you like it, no regrets.
I don't like it. I love it. It's beautiful here.
Mary didn't have a P.O. box in Philly. but she's got one at the Elmore store. And she says bopping downstairs to check her mail has been a great way to meet her new community.
I mean, we bought a bookcase from a guy that we met getting our mail.
And then there's Ed Olson, who visits the Elmore post office just about every day.
I think it's like the little hub for the town.
Today, Ed's here to grab a newspaper, chat with his neighbors, and check his mail.
We've been doing this for 40 years.
You've had a P.O. box here for 40 years?
Yes. We could survive without it, but it'd be a lot harder, and it would break down, I think, a little bit of what creates a community here.
People in Elmore are particularly appreciative of their post office, in part because not long ago, they almost lost it. At the start of 2022, the U.S. Postal Service announced that they would be pulling the little gold P.O. boxes from the store the following month. They never gave a reason, but the owners suspected it was because the office wasn't bringing in enough money. Elmore residents banded together to fight back. There are fewer than 1,000 people in town, but hundreds of them signed petitions and wrote letters to the Postal Service. Even the congressional delegation got on board, including then-Congressman Peter Welch.
We're going to have the Postal Service stop delivering here at the Elmore Country Store. That's not right, and it's not going to happen.
And after all that, the community won. The Postal Service walked back its closure plan and renewed a contract with the Elmore store. But the problems facing the Postal Service, the ones that led them to try to close the Elmore post office, they haven't gone away. And in a lot of ways, they've gotten worse.
Welcome to Brave Little State, Vermont Public's listener-powered journalism show. Every episode starts with a question that's been asked by you, our audience. Today, why is there such a problem with the U.S. Postal Service in Vermont? It's a vital institution that so many people love, but changes at the national level over the past half century are coming to a head here in Vermont.
449 days! We're waiting, and we're not going to take it any longer.
Brave Little State's Burgess Brown travels around the state to witness these challenges firsthand.
I mean, you can look through this prime. Those are all prime.
And he traces the history to figure out how we got here.
Postal officials, in seriousness, they actually considered burning the mail to sort of restart the system.
We need to get it out of our heads that we're business, because we're not.
Brave Little State is a proud member of the NPR network. Welcome.
Welcome to the 1960s.
Well, hello, my friend. How do you do? We hope you have a moment or two to listen to what we have to say. To each and every one of you.
It concerns our postal system.
This is your new favorite band, the Swingin' Six. And they've just landed the gig of a lifetime. A 1967 post office public service announcement. There's trouble in the postal world, and big changes are afoot. Well, here, they'll tell you all about it.
Well, back in the days of the 13 colonies, cry was freedom and how to defend it. Mailing a letter wasn't much trouble.
There weren't too many places to send it.
But now it's a different story.
They've got more mail than ever before.
It's stuffed in bags, stacked on shelves.
There's hardly room for anything more.
There's been a mail explosion.
They've got a terrible load.
They're not kidding about a mail explosion. In the decades following World War II, mail volume across the country doubled. And the Postal Service just couldn't keep up.
Now all of a sudden you have trucks backed up with mail that simply can't be processed.
This is Ryan Ellis again, the postal scholar.
Postal officials, in seriousness, they actually considered burning the mail to sort of restart the system. So the system is clogged by this influx of mail in a system that is just like straining under the weight.
Something had to give. And a postal strike, the largest walkout ever against the federal government, was the final straw.
And out of this sort of maelstrom comes the Postal Reorganization Act of 1970.
The Postal Reorganization Act created the United States Postal Service as we know it today. It made a bunch of different changes, but the key one was this. The Postal Service became an independent agency with a mandate to fund itself, meaning no more tax dollars. All postal operations were to be funded through the sale of things like stamps and shipments. So the idea here was theoretically to give the Postal Service more flexibility so that they could respond to this increased mail volume by innovating and upgrading systems as they saw fit. Running it less like an agency and more like a business.
Does it work well? Some things really do improve, right? They do invest in automation. They do speed up the moving of the mail. They are able to do it with fewer workers to a degree. Long overdue investments do get made.
But the successes were overshadowed by a sort of existential confusion over what the Postal Service was ultimately supposed to be. A sustainable business or a public service?
This thing, which is neither fish nor fowl, is just hard, right? We don't ask our police force or our fire department to be revenue neutral, but we ask our Postal Service to do that. And so it has these dual competing obligations to be sort of businesslike on the one hand, but also perform its core service functions on the other that are always, always in tension.
Neither fish nor fowl. Not quite a business and not quite a public service. There are, of course, more policies and technological advances that have had a big impact on the Postal Service since, like the advent of email, for example, and a 2006 law that required the Postal Service to pre-fund 75 years' worth of retiree health benefits. But ultimately, this tension that the Postal Service is expected to perform a public service that's not profitable while also running like a business that breaks even, we're still grappling with that today, across the country and right here in Vermont.
We need to get it out of our heads that we're a business, because we're not.
This is Caitlin Hopkins. She's the president of the American Postal Workers Union of Vermont. Caitlin grew up in Pomfret and, like me, had a rosy vision of the Postal Service.
My bus stop in Pomfret was the post office. So when we were waiting for parents, we'd go in and we would say hi to whoever was manning the counter at the time, which for a while it was a guy named Andy, and then it was Rosie. Those were very formative people in terms of forming my perception of the post office, of being, okay, this is a great place to be. They know everybody. It always felt like a very positive thing.
But then in 2015, she took a job with the Postal Service, and she says some of her perceptions were shattered.
Quickly found out that it's very much a face that is put on for the public, and really struggled to adapt because the management style of the post office is very much a case of all the bad is rolling downhill. And when there's more pressure on managers, then there's more pressure on the people below them. And then you start seeing a lot of mental health issues in the post office.
We reached out to the regional representative for the USPS to ask about some of these concerns, by the way, and didn't hear back in time for this story. Anyway, Caitlin's been with the Postal Service for 9 years and says it's always been tough. But she can pinpoint a moment when everything got a whole lot worse.
Postal workers have been key in helping Americans remember life before the pandemic. Mail deliveries have continued as usual, but it's not clear how much longer they'll be able to do that.
The COVID-19 pandemic led to an increase in online shopping, which created this massive spike in demand for the Postal Service. This was good for revenue, but widespread illness among essential delivery workers meant there weren't enough staff to handle the spike. Those that were healthy worked long, brutal hours to try to make up for the shortages. And at the same time, a new postmaster general was putting his stamp, if you'll allow me, on the service. Louis DeJoy. Louis DeJoy was appointed Postmaster General in 2020 during President-elect Donald Trump's first term in office. DeJoy has a background in logistics and freight, and in his 10-year plan for the Postal Service, he made it clear that in the tug of war between business and service, he was squarely on the side of business. Cost cutting was priority number one. This meant reducing hours that post offices are open or outright closing them like they tried to do in Elmore. It meant slowing down delivery times for first-class mail and getting rid of overtime for mail carriers, all while raising prices for certain services. So, in Vermont, if you've been noticing slower delivery times, reduced post office hours, and higher prices, this is not a glitch in the system. It's all part of DeJoy's 10-year plan. And according to Caitlin Hopkins, this higher package volume combined with cost-cutting measures and a difficult workplace culture is contributing to what she sees as the main issue with the Postal Service in Vermont, a worker shortage.
We're trying to fill in the gaps where we can because we can no longer hire. So many people across the state have worked for the post office, or they know somebody who's worked for the post office and they had a miserable experience and they won't recommend it. They can't in good conscience recommend it.
The numbers back this up. In fiscal year 2022, nearly 60% of all early career employees left the Postal Service nationwide. And then last year, a third of all new hires left within 90 days. And to Caitlin's point, filling these vacant positions has been slow. In Vermont, at the time of writing, there are 93 vacant positions listed on the USPS job portal, and the majority of them are for rural carriers. Earlier this year, some Waterbury residents stopped getting mail delivered to their houses altogether when the USPS couldn't fill a vacant rural mail carrier position. And last year, some in Hinesburg went weeks without receiving mail. In Bethel and Randolph, customers struggled to get their medication and their inhalers. It's worth noting that you're only going to hear from a couple of Postal Service employees in this piece, and that's because postal workers are highly discouraged from speaking to the press, and some fear retaliation if they cast the service in a bad light. Postal woes have been felt from coast to coast in recent years, but nowhere in this state have the Postal Service's issues been more heated and more symbolic than our capital city.
You know who hasn't shown up? United States Postal Service leadership.
But you know who has shown up? This guy. It's a frigid day in January 2024, and people in Montpelier are pissed.
182 days! That's how long Montpelier has been without a post office.
A couple hundred concerned Montpelierites are gathered in front of the federal building in downtown Montpelier. It used to house the city's post office until it flooded in the summer of 2023. 6 months later, it's still sitting there, empty.
In the days after the July flood, the residents and friends of Montpelier showed up.
Ben Doyle is standing at a microphone on the slushy sidewalk, flanked by members of Vermont's congressional delegation. Ben chairs the Montpelier Commission for Recovery and Resilience, created last year to respond to the devastating July flood.
Teenagers mucked out basements. Neighbors checked on neighbors. The delegation showed up. The governor showed up. Philanthropy showed up. You showed up. But 182 days later, you know who hasn't shown up? United States Postal Service leadership.
Those 182 days were a confusing and often frustrating time for Montpelier residents. For a while, the makeshift postal presence in town consisted of two or three delivery trucks that served as ad hoc P.O. boxes, surrounded by stacks of plastic crates overflowing with mail and packages. They didn't sell stamps and only accepted prepaid mail, so residents had to drive to Barrie or East Montpelier for that. There was no electricity and no AC in the summer, and then as temperatures dropped, no heat. At one point in the autumn, postal workers were burning open fires in a metal tub to keep warm while they handed out mail. Concerned citizens and the congressional delegation wrote letters to management demanding that Postmaster General DeJoy provide a timeline for a new permanent post office location. But nothing. Residents' patience was wearing thin, like local business owner Kate Welly McCabe.
We are not asking for a miracle here. What we're asking for is for our federal government to do the most basic of things, and that is to give us a working post office right here in town.
Johanna Nichols said that the trek to neighboring Barrie to use postal services there was hurting Montpelier's seniors.
Have you tried the entrance to the Barrie post office? It's pretty tricky.
The pressure campaign continued through the winter, and in April, the Postal Service announced they'd signed a lease on a downtown property. They promised a fully functional post office before the start of the summer. But the summer came, and the summer went, and then the fall, and still, no post office. In October, the American Postal Workers Union rallied on the State House lawn, and Ben Doyle showed up with some updated figures.
449 days! We're waiting, and we're not going to take it any longer.
One of the most consistent criticisms I heard during this time was that Montpelier residents didn't really know where to go to get their mail or what the plan was for the future. They were frustrated by the lack of communication from Postal Service management.
Like, yeah, we can write them or we can call them and they're not going to get back to us, or they don't really care what we think, or we're howling to the wind.
Ben, townspeople, our congressional delegation spent 15 months howling into the wind. And then, in the midst of my reporting for this story, 460 days after the flood and with little fanfare, it finally happened.
You've got the scissors. As the postmaster, you can be cutting the ribbon.
It's Saturday, October 12th in downtown Montpelier, and there's a grand opening happening.
First and foremost, welcome everyone to the Montpelier Post Office. This is certainly an exciting day in Montpelier Post Office history, and we're so very thankful to so many of you who have worked tirelessly to get this office back open.
Michael Hakey, a postal operations manager, is presiding over this celebration. Press people appear to outnumber townspeople, and there are only four press people.
We'll now cut the ribbon, which will signify the official grand opening of the Montpelier Post Office. We have Postmaster Doug Powell. We'll cut the ribbon.
We're officially open.
Excellent. Congratulations. Perfect. Thank you.
Did you catch that? Congratulations, or thank you. That sounds about right. Congratulations, you got your post office back, or thank you for your patience. It's hard to know what to make of this day when it took so long to arrive. And then when it finally did, it kind of arrived with a bit of a whimper. After the ribbon cutting, I watched locals peer into the windows and then kind of timidly walk in to see if, this time, their post office really was open. And whatever their gripes with the Postal Service, they were glad to see a familiar face behind the counter.
It was great to see you, Ned. All right, I'll see you soon.
Wendy Gillander, a post office clerk in Montpelier.
So it's been great. Yeah. I'm really happy to be back and seeing our regular customers again on a more regular basis, yeah. I guess I would say.
Wendy spent the last 460 days in snow, in rain, and heat, in Montpelier, in Barrie, and Berlin, making sure that Montpelier residents got their mail. Wendy knows her neighbors, and she knows their kids, and she knows their dogs, and they all know her, too.
Yay! Thank you so much. I'm glad you have a home.
That was Brave Little State's Burgess Brown. Michaela Lafrak here. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going hunting together, so get your blaze orange on. That's in a minute on Vermont Edition. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Today, we are sharing two recent episodes of Brave Little State, Vermont Public's listener-driven podcast. Our next story comes to us from a Northeast Kingdom high schooler. She wants to understand why so many people she knows are so into the same pastime, hunting. Brave Little State takes it from here.
From Vermont Public and the NPR Network, this is Brave Little State. I'm Burgess Brown.
And I'm Lola DeFore. If you ask a hunter how they got into hunting, you're likely to hear something like this.
My dad hunts, so I kind of grew up around hunters.
I had hunting in the family, so I just grew up hunting.
I've been raised from hunting. My family hunted and all that.
And that's what I heard, what you just heard, when I sat down with a group of high school boys in Danville. Now, the reason I'm talking to you about hunting today is because of Alex Larrabee. She's a sophomore at Danville, a K-12 school in the Northeast Kingdom. I'm the youth and education reporter at Vermont Public, and so for this episode, my Brave Little State debut, I thought it'd be fun to collect questions from high school students around the state and then put our favorites up for a public vote. And Alex Larrabee's question won. She wanted to know about how hunting has changed in Vermont, if it's gotten more or less popular over time, but she's not just curious about statistics.
I've always wondered, like, what is the fascination of hunting? Like, why do people like to hunt so much?
Now, Alex doesn't hunt, but a lot of the people around her do. Her dad hunts, her older sister, who's now in the military, she hunted. And as you heard, a ton of her classmates, mostly boys, they hunt. And what she's noticed is that the people who go hunting, they love it. Here's another one of Alex's classmates, Sebastian Eldred.
I just look for, like, counting down the days every day, every year, to whatever season it is.
It can be kind of boring to be a teen anywhere, especially in a rural town. But the kids who hunt, Alex says it feels like they look forward to the weekend in a way few people do.
It's not like a casual thing. A lot of the people I know, they hunt, like, every day after school, and they hunt, like, all weekend.
Like Dylan Costa.
How big a part of your life is hunting?
It's most of my life. If, like, during the summertime when nothing's open, I'm pretty well bored. I look forward to hunting all year round. Like, right now, turkey season isn't until May, and I'm already looking forward to that, so.
I've also noticed how emotionally potent it is. Sure, hunting is kind of this ubiquitous thing in Vermont culture. There's camo and hunter's orange everywhere. In November, a lot of local shops will advertise hunter's widow sales, you know, for the partners who are quote-unquote left behind during hunting season. But it's the way hunting animates people that interests me and that interests Alex. And her observation that people who hunt don't really do it casually, it's actually borne out by the state's licensing data. If someone gets, say, a fishing license, maybe they'll get one next year, and maybe they won't. But it's not the same with hunting. If you hunt one year, you're almost certainly going to hunt the next, and the next, and the next. People who hunt basically hunt until they can't anymore. I don't hunt. So I figured the best way, and probably the only way, to answer Alex's questions about who hunts and why the heck they like it so much was to head into the woods and see for myself. I hope you'll tag along. It's an hour before dawn, and my producer Burgess and I are headed to an undisclosed mountain in Addison County. We're not going to be too specific as to where, because Alex Smith, not to be confused with our question asker Alex Larrabee, has asked us to please not blow up his spot.
Not that, like, this is a big secret or something, but
It's a good spot. And
it's like a good swimming spot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Alex is our hunter guide and one of the nicest people I've ever met. When we meet up with him, dawn is breaking. And while that's extremely early for me, it's actually pretty late for Alex, who would have been out here by 4 o'clock if it weren't for us.
You'll see the sun rising over Mount Abe and the mountains in Lincoln, and you'll see the Adirondacks sort of, you know, begin to
We're parked on a logging road, and Alex is holding a bowl of oatmeal and blueberries while he's talking. But I don't think Burgess and I ever catch him taking a single bite. He's just too excited.
And it's just like the most, there's no other time of day like it. All the birds kind of start coming alive in the springtime, especially.
If you couldn't tell already, Alex is an extremely avid hunter. He's been doing it most of his life. And now he's on the leadership team for the Vermont chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. And he's so good at hunting that today, just 3 days into Vermont's rifle season, he's already bagged a buck in Vermont and another in New York, which is all he's allowed for the season. But he's generously found two other people who still have deer tags, and that's who we're meeting in the woods. Bailey Walker, a Middlebury College student who grew up hunting in Colorado, and Emmett Smith, Alex's cousin, who recently took up hunting.
Shall we take a walk?
And
we'll have some.
Now, you're hearing all these leaves crunching because there's no snow on the ground, which for a big woods hunter like Alex is kind of a bummer.
So I grew up in Long Lake in the center of the Adirondacks, and around there for a lot of people, like, hunting season doesn't even really start till there's snow on the ground. I don't know if my dad knows when opening day is. He just, like, would go buy his hunting license when he saw snow in the forecast and go out, you know.
Following buck tracks through the snow is just the most straightforward way to hunt, at least in mountainous terrain. It's also the best way to hunt bigger bucks because you can actually tell deer tracks apart in the snow. But nowadays, you can't really count on snow falling in time for rifle season. And so hunters like Alex are making do by studying the more subtle clues that tell you where deer might be.
It's been a fun way to get better at hunting, to slow down more. And I feel like I get better shots that way, creeping up on deer and seeing more deer that don't see me than before.
So the day's lack of snow will dictate the day's slow and steady hunting strategy. We mostly walk along at a leisurely pace, sometimes through the very lovely woods and sometimes through some very unlovely brambles, looking for signs of deer. Emmett, Alex's cousin, notices something.
Straight there. You can kind of see the bare trees. You'll need to use your binoculars to see what I'm looking at.
Moose rub.
Moose?
Moose, yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. It's like, that's it.
Yeah,
a lot of activity for a deer.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that was a moose rub.
Because there are so many of us and the leaves mean we're making quite a bit of noise, Alex has decided we'll try and use sound to our advantage. He sets Bailey and Emmett up in these saddles, that's low points along the ridgeline, while Burgess, Alex, and I set up shop between them up top. Then Alex walks around, clanking these antlers together. Deer are pretty curious creatures, and the hope is that one of them will come see what sounds like two bucks fighting. So, just to recap, Alex has positioned two armed and hidden men on either side of himself, and then he's walking between them and impersonating the creature they're trying to kill. Burgess remarks on how funny this all sounds.
This feels like a dumb question, but it feels, crazy to go to set people up with guns around you and then walk around and
smack antlers together.
Yeah.
Blazed orange is a critical component of this play.
But on this Tuesday morning, the play doesn't work. After a totally deer-free hour, Alex calls Bailey and Emmett up the mountain. But Alex, an inveterate optimist, is not one for quitting. We will repeat this process several times in several spots across the mountain. No luck. In the afternoon, we try a new tactic that involves splitting up our party around a pond.
Shoot straight.
No luck there either. And at this point, honestly, I've started to pray no one shoots a deer. I haven't been seized by doubts about the morality of hunting, to be clear. I'm just exhausted. We've been in the woods for 6 or 7 hours, and the last thing I want is to finish this hike by dragging a 150-pound carcass out of the woods. My wish comes true. No one kills a deer today. But we do talk about it, what it means to kill what you eat.
For very few people that I've ever been around, it's like a huge, you know, fist pumping experience to kill a deer. Like, it's, you know, it's a little somber.
To hunt something successfully, you kind of have to develop a reverence for the animal you're killing. At least that's true for Alex, and it's true for a lot of the hunters I talk to.
It's not like we're at war with deer, you know. Like, we love them. We also love to hunt them. We love to eat them, and they're, you know, you kill a deer and you get, you know, like a year's worth of meat, you know, which is a huge deal. So it's big, and we're very determined to do it. But it's you know, it's certainly it's heavy, and it gets heavier. I think the older I get, the, you know, the more time between pulling the trigger and getting excited it takes. They're just an amazing animal, you know.
At the end of the day, we're in Alex's truck getting a ride back to our cars. He asks us if we've caught the hunting bug, and I tell him, to be perfectly honest, no. I am not one for waking up this early to be that cold and that wet for that long. But I can honestly say that I am full of admiration for this uniquely difficult practice, and Alex gets it.
Whenever I'm explaining it to somebody who doesn't do it, it often sounds like a whole lot of things that wouldn't be very fun. I can see how, like, it's a collection of somewhat torturous events. And for some reason, it's totally under my skin. But it doesn't get under everybody's skin.
Hey, it's Michaela LaFrac again. Time for one more short break. When we come back, we're going to learn about the demographics of hunting in Vermont and how they're changing. That's in just a minute on Vermont Edition. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. If you're just joining us, we are listening to a recent episode of Brave Little State all about hunting. I'll hand things back over to reporter Lola Dufort.
Podcasters aren't the only people who ask other people somewhat intrusive and occasionally indulgent questions about feelings and why they do whatever it is they do. Anthropologists like Mark Boglioli, they do that too.
You know, some of those questions are hard to answer.
Mark, who hunts and teaches at Drew University, wrote this book about hunting in contemporary Vermont called A Matter of Life and Death. And he's interested in the sorts of questions that I'm interested in, that Alex Larrabee is interested in, the why of it all. But he also had this professor back in the 90s who would kind of rib him about it.
And he would say, I can tell you why people hunt. It's not about how they feel about animals or some mystical thing, Mark. He goes, the reason they hunt is because they're male, they grew up in a rural area, they're white, and their father hunted. That's why they hunt.
Mark's professor was this guy named Tom Hepperlein, and he wrote this landmark paper with his wife Betty Thompson in the early 90s that foretold the end of hunting. Based on demographic trends, he predicted hunting as we know it would basically be extinct by 2050. It made a big splash in the hunting and conservation community. And over a quarter century later, a lot of people think Hepperlein was kind of prophetic. As America got less white and more urban, hunting participation rates did decline. But there's reason to think demographics may not necessarily be destiny.
In that basic, like, combination of, like, variables there, like the rural, the white, male, those things don't necessarily always stay the same. So that's why some of those predictions don't necessarily play out. For example, nationally, in the last 10 years, the numbers of women hunting has doubled.
And if you do a quick Google search on women's hunting apparel, it's considered a huge growth market. So part of the predicted losses have been made up by this new demographic, women entering the sport.
Some of those things really can't be predicted from the models from the 80s and 90s that kind of had a, you know, not an untrue, but a particular view of who a hunter was that might be changing.
Now, I'll note that Vermont appears to actually be lagging the rest of the country in terms of getting women into hunting. But the state data does show more women getting into the sport over time. Women like Nicole Meyer.
I'm a 36-year-old white woman who's all of 5 feet tall when I'm wearing heels.
Nicole coordinates hunter education programs for Vermont Fish and Wildlife. You may notice that Nicole is not like other people you've heard from so far in this episode. She's not a man. Her dad didn't teach her how to hunt. And she came to hunting not as a kid, but as a young adult. It happened when she was working for the New York Department of Environmental Conservation after college.
I had this stereotype in my mind that all hunters were this Elmer Fudd type of guy who was really rednecky and dumb, and I was blown away at how wrong I was about my stereotypes of who a hunter is. I met this guy named Ed O'Connell, and he could tell you where a deer was going to be based on the temperature, the wind direction, and how much like sunlight there was. And I had never met someone who could communicate or know animals that intimately. I thought it was this superpower that he had, and that just kind of had me in a trance.
So at 22, Nicole picked up a gun for the first time. She took hunter education courses in a VFW with a bunch of 11 and 12-year-olds who knew every answer to the instructor's questions. She sat in the back and prayed she wouldn't get picked on. But eventually, she got the hang of it. The key was a good mentor, and that's something hunters can't emphasize enough. You really can't get into hunting unless someone is there next to you in the woods, walking you through every single step. Now, Nicole is one of the more than 3 million women who hunt in the United States. A U.S. Fish and Wildlife survey in 2022 found that 22% of all hunters in America are women. That's more than double the participation rates from 20 years ago. And there's also this other kind of person that's getting into hunting. People with more, shall we say, urbane sensibilities. People who like their food local, seasonal, and free range.
I gave a talk a few years ago at University of Wyoming on hipster hunters. Like, hipster hunter is a term now.
Mark Boglioli again.
For better or for worse, there's a lot more white guys with beards down to their waist driving Toyota Tacomas running to Vermont to gather edible plants. Like, who predicted that?
And Vermont is leaning really hard into this trend. That's not particularly surprising, given how big the local farm and food scene is here. Now, most of the people enrolling in hunter education courses, they're still mostly young boys from rural parts of the state. But Nicole says there's been a spike in adults showing up, mostly because of this interest in local food and self-sufficiency.
We're having these really fantastic conversations with people who think local food is important and that it's not so different to grow a zucchini in your garden and then eat it. That's not so different than going out hunting in your backyard and bringing home a squirrel to make squirrel pot pie, or a deer to make venison tacos, or whatever. It's been so.
This is why she's been traveling to farmers markets to hand out venison sliders. And it's why the state has started Vermont Wild Kitchen, a cooking class that brings local farmers, foragers, hunters, and anglers together to share recipes. So part of Alex Larrabee's winning question is about hunting trends in Vermont over time. Are there more hunters, less hunters? If you just looked at annual hunting license sales, you would think participation in hunting was falling off a cliff. For the past few decades, numbers have been going down, 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 even if you account for growth and demographics like women and quote-unquote hipster hunters. But it turns out it's really tough to tell an accurate story about these trends. That's because in the mid-90s, the state started offering the option of a lifetime permit.
Vermonters love a deal, and they've been exceedingly popular.
This is Chris Saunders, who handles license data for Vermont Fish and Wildlife. Today, you can buy an infant a lifetime hunting permit for a little over $200.
Probably, you know, some years, 18 to 20% of all the infants born in Vermont are being gifted these licenses.
Basically, the people hunting with these lifetime permits, they were invisible in the state's annual license data for a while. In 2017, the state finally required people with these lifetime permits to register for free with the state each year if they were actually out in the field hunting. And overnight, there were over 12,000 additional hunters being captured by the state's tally. And except for this spike during the pandemic, between 2017 and 2023, the number of hunters has basically stayed the same at 70,000.
There are fewer people hunting than there were in the 70s and 80s. That is undeniable. But at least last 5 years, and I think the last 10 years at least, hunting participation has been pretty darn stable.
Now, before anyone accuses Chris or I of being Pollyannas about the state of hunting in Vermont, demographics do present a challenge. That, of course, should surprise absolutely nobody that's read a single article about the state of Vermont in the last 10 years. Participation rates are higher with older Vermonters than with younger Vermonters. And those older Vermonters, they will eventually age out of the sport. But honestly, when I've talked to hunters about their anxieties around the future of the sport, what really concerns them isn't whether we'll run out of hunters. It's whether we'll run out of land. You don't need to come from a rural place to hunt. An urban transplant can learn just fine. But you do need a rural landscape to hunt. And as more and more people post their land and sprawl creeps into the hills, the forest increasingly becomes off limits to hunters. And for hunters like Nicole, connection to the land isn't just necessary to hunt. It's also kind of the whole point.
The intimacy that you have with nature when you're hunting and trying to be part of the environment is, it's unparalleled, it's beautiful. I was hunting a flock of turkeys one spring, and I was just too far off to get a shot. And then out of the corner of my eye, I see this movement down this hillside, and it was a bobcat coming down the hill slowly, and I realized the bobcat was hunting the same turkeys that I was hunting. And there was part of me that was like, yes, you get those turkeys. I want to see that. That is amazing. And there's part of me that's like, oh, no, you don't. Those are my turkeys. So it kind of felt like I'm obviously not a bobcat, but it felt like I was a predator too. I didn't shoot a turkey that day. That was one of my best days of hunting ever.
Sally, for the big jug of vinegar.
Yeah.
And oh man, maybe actually, can you wash that knife too while you're at it?
I'm back at Alex Smith's place. That's our hunter guide from earlier, in a wood shop behind his house. And right now I'm looking at a fairly gory scene. A large rib cage and spine, with most of the meat cut away. There's also some bloodshot meat off to the side, which can't get processed because that's where Alex's bullet struck through the deer's neck.
So yeah, that's the unusable portion of a, you know, 150-pound buck. That and the height and head, like I said.
This is the deer Alex bagged on the opening day of Vermont's rifle season, a few days before our less successful outing. He's agreed to let me watch as he processes what's left of it. Because we've had a bit of a warm spell, Alex couldn't leave the deer hanging to cure. Instead, he skinned and quartered it, storing the backstraps and shoulders in three large coolers on the floor. Now he's taking maybe 15 pounds of flesh out of those coolers at a time and butchering it into smaller pieces.
You know, it's not rocket science with a deer. It really is basically just separating muscles out, you know.
It's pretty remarkable how much meat a deer can provide. The two that Alex shot this season will provide his family of four the bulk of their meat through the year. But Alex jokes that when his two boys get older and start eating the way he once did, they're going to have to start pulling their own weight in the game department. And that's when his cousin, Emmett, chimes in with a joke.
Well, you can start picking them up off the road, too.
Yeah, no, nab them off the road. We could take them anywhere we can get them. People are quick to jump on the roadkill in Addison County. I like that about this place.
Yesterday, too. I feel like
Emmett got into hunting from having a bad roadkill year.
Now, Emmett isn't alone. Plenty of people salvage roadkill for food here in Vermont and have for a long time. There's even a state program for it. But while some people might turn to roadkill when they have a bad hunting year, Emmett did the opposite. He says it started because his ex didn't eat farmed animal products.
But she would eat game, and she had gotten into the habit of picking up roadkill and taught me the fine art of it.
Emmett explains that his ex, she was a vegan because of climate change. But if you're thinking about your food's carbon footprint, roadkill is kind of unimpeachable.
I'm having a little self-conscious moment here being with this microphone. You know how, like, the weirdest thing about you becomes the thing that everybody finds out about first?
Oh, you're right.
Right. So, yeah. This is something that often comes up at dinner parties, you know, whether roadkill's on the menu or not.
Remember the wave of so-called hipster hunters our anthropologist friend Mark was describing earlier? Emmett fits the bill. He came to hunting from an interest in sustainability, and when we were out hunting, he was using a vintage rifle, a Winchester Model 94, the hipsterest of hipster guns, according to Alex. Growing up, Emmett's dad didn't hunt. Neither did his friend group of art kids, punks, and nerds. In high school, he might not have fit in with those hunter boys in Danville you heard at the beginning of this story. But now that he's out in the woods, he sure sounds a lot like them to me.
I think one of the things I find most rewarding about it is it forces you to be really mindful in the moment, forces you to be really present. You can go from being in the woods, seeing an animal, taking it apart, going through all of the emotions involved in that. And it is a very emotional process that I think we're very separated from in most of our meat consumption. And every part of that is just... it's not always easy, but it's rewarding, and it's sort of essential to the human experience in a way that is very meaningful.
Alex Larrabee asked us two questions. She wanted to know how many people hunt and why they hunt. And maybe this is where Tom Heberlein, the famous sociologist who foretold the end of hunting, maybe got it a little wrong when he collapsed both those questions. Remember when he told Mark that people hunt because they're men, they're rural, and their dads hunted? That may be how most people got into hunting in the 70s and 80s. But I don't think that's why they hunted then, at least not primarily. And it's not why people hunt now. Because whether you're a rural kid who inherited the tradition from your dad, or an urban transplant who got into the sport later in life, I think it really is about how you feel about animals, or nature, or some mystical thing.
Do you eat meat that's not hunted or roadkill anymore?
I do, yeah. I don't make any claim to ethical purity, I guess, on that front.
I make a lot of claims towards purity in that department until I see a Stewart's chili dog. I eat free-range organic venison and Stewart's chili dogs.
Thanks to Brave Little State for sharing their reporting with us today. For more stories about Vermont and your curiosity, make sure to subscribe or follow Brave Little State in your favorite podcast app. And if you want to vote on a topic of an upcoming episode or submit your own question about Vermont, just head to bravelittlestate.org. The episodes you heard today were reported by Burgess Brown and Lola Dufour. Brave Little State's team is Josh Crane, Burgess Brown, and Sabine Pooks, and the executive producer is Angela Evansy. Theme music by Ty Gibbons, other music by Blue Dot Sessions. Vermont Edition is produced by John Ahrens, Andrea Lorien, and Daniela Fierro. Our theme music is by Myra Flynn. I'm Michaela LaFrac. For the rest of the week, we will be airing special programming. Vermont Edition will be back next Monday with brand new live shows. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch up again soon.